This is a podcast from the AHRC ICT Methods Network at www.methodsnetwork.ac.uk.
Thank you. I did worry when I was writing this paper, having been to a computing history a conference a couple of years ago, that in case it ended up as me and my project, you know, like me and my website kind of presentation. But what I've tried to do in the presentation is to talk about the way that I've used the methodology to develop perhaps a slightly different approach to using archives. The Health of the Cecils project, covering the period 1550-1660, is funded by Wellcome for 3 years. And it's studying attitudes to and the experience of healthcare in one of the great aristocratic households of early modern England. And I've extended the study to the wider family and household servants, as well as their political and social contacts. And as part of the project, I've designed a webpage so that if anybody wanted to find out more about it, they could go online and do that. And that is the web address. Now, the sources for the project are manuscript collections, and these are unstructured sources. They're not institutional archives. They're not coherent. They are very diverse. The large proportion of them was the Salisbury papers at Hatfield House, and as many of you know, these can be read on microfilm, or a large proportion of them can be read on microfilm at the British Library. And in addition, there are the Lansdowne papers at the British Library, state papers at Kew, and a number of other smaller collections. So the archives are spread over a number of different repositories. Evidence of healthcare has been found in a wide variety of sources, including bills, accounts, medicinal and culinary receipts, medical reports, and above all in letters. So the diversity of sources and the number of collections presented significant opportunities as well as challenges when choosing appropriate software. Funding was granted to a named researcher, that's myself, for 3 years with costs allowed for computer and software with a monograph as outcome, and that was to be written by the directors of the project and myself. And in addition, the possibility of publishing the sources was to be explored. So the main outcome of the book is a traditional monograph. And this obviously influenced the choice of software. And the fact that we were looking at attitudes and relationships meant that we were looking at qualitative data analysis. And this, I feel, fits very much in the first generational kind of project that people were talking about yesterday. So I'm asking you to think laterally in that there are a large number of historians who are, I mean, some of them perhaps even technophobes, some of them who are only mildly conversant with computer programs. I met a young postdoc recently who used Excel, but didn't feel very comfortable with anything more than that. So I think there are still a large number of people out there for whom software, not of the complexity that we've been considering in the last, yesterday and earlier this morning, but straightforward software, which is not difficult to learn, can have a really important role to play in their training. And this software, I think, allows collaboration, and I think collaboration as part of the project is really very important at certain key stages. So, this collaboration with the directors in the final analysis was they were to share the sources that I had transcribed, I had entered and coded. So the key point for me was to look for software that was easy to learn how to search and to draw conclusions at the end. And it also had to be able to manage a large number of documents, of very diverse kinds of documents, and from the large number of repositories. Qualitative data analysis software has been developed mainly for use by social and political scientists, who often use unstructured interviews or group discussions as the basis for their research. This creates some disadvantages when applying the software to a historical project. For example, many historians need to work with a very large number of documents. Historical data already exists, and historians have to deal with a lot of fuzzy or missing data, which can create problems with quantitative analysis. Many social scientists are designing projects where data collection has yet to be carried out. All of these factors influence the way developers design the software. However, the same developers express interest in meeting the needs of users, so I believe that if in the future more historians decide to use the software, we will be able to influence the programmers and developers and obtain more specific facilities appropriate to use in historical sources. The views expressed in this paper are based on my experience using the software NVivo over the past 2.5 years. And I'm not here to endorse the product over other programs. I'm only making this point to explain particular references which might not apply to other software. I mean, other software such as Atlas TI, Max QDA, the Ethnograph, and there are a variety of others. I've been asked why I chose to use commercial rather than open software, and I think my answer is pragmatic, based on the time available, the funding available, and the need to complete the project on time. There is open source QDA software, but it's comparatively undeveloped and as yet not able to offer the sophistication of commercial packages. Clear advice on software and their different capabilities is available from Anne Lewis and Christina Silva at the CACDAS networking project at Surrey, which gave me extremely useful advice, and they have written a paper which analyses all the software packages and their different advantages, and I'd be happy to give the address, but it's also in the printout of the paper. So using the software, the documents are entered into the software using the original spelling and language with translations added alongside. We had quite a lot of Latin documents, so those are entered in Latin and then the translations added. The analysis then is done on the English sources, and the sources are very close. All the analysis remains very close to the documents throughout. And I think in some software packages, you can enter the images of the documents, so you can bring the documents that much closer to your analysis. Other programs, you can enter video material and audio tapes, which is particularly useful for modern historians. Odd documents were entered using RTF, which did create some problems because we had some short sections in Greek, and also we had quite a lot of apothecary symbols which couldn't be entered. That, with the new version of NVivo, that problem has been solved. The apothecary's bills couldn't be entered into the original software, but with the new version, which has just come out a month ago, we can now put the apothecary's bills in tables. So most of the problems have been resolved, but I think it's worth it, if anyone else is thinking about doing that, make certain that you can enter whatever language it is into the software when you're thinking about planning. So because so many of our sources were privately owned, we didn't think about entering images of the documents. We wouldn't have got permission for that. We had to enter transcripts. Now, because we're entering transcripts, either partial or full, in the way that these are made in the conventional history project, we were not constrained by the software. So our methods are dictated by historical requirements. The software remains the tool of the researcher. It does not at any stage dictate methodology. And the other advantage is it didn't require lengthy specific training to input data. This is the structure of the project. On the left-hand side there, you can see that the archives are kept separate. The top arrow is, that's Lansdowne. This was a collection of the other very small archives. HMCS refers to Salisbury. These memos are records of how the project works. There we have state papers. On the other side are listed the all the documents from the whole collection. These are all from Salisbury, they're kept together. And on this one, you can see that each letter has its unique identifier. And this took some working out, this coding. HMCS represented Salisbury, then you've got the date, then the month, and then the day. And that meant that you can find the documents really quite easily when you've got a very large collection of them. And then when you've got very small snippets, because a lot of these are partial transcripts, I collected them together so you have smaller miscellaneous documents, so that if you're worried about having enormous numbers of documents, if you group them together, that seems to work quite well. When we came to trying to devise the structure, obviously all the guidebooks exist for social scientists, so we had to try and work out for ourselves how to do this. And we received some invaluable help from Duncan Branley at Goldsmiths, who works on training QDA techniques at Goldsmiths. So we can reconstitute the archives. We can search either all of the archives together, or we can search, say, Salisbury papers. That can be done by the way that we've organised this. I managed to find, although it wasn't allowed for in the budget, sufficient funds to hire two PhD students when we were devising this structure, and that was enormously helpful. One was a medical sociologist who was working with Korean immigrants and was dealing with a lot of similar medical concepts to the ones I was dealing with in the 16th century, and the other was a media studies PhD student, and he brought other skills to discussing the structure. So, when we came to the coding, I'm conscious here of the way that Tim was talking in the previous paper about searching unstructured archives and trying to impose some kind of order to draw together ideas out of them. You've seen how the documents were collected together. And what we had to try and do was to devise a coding structure which could draw out as much as possible of the richness of the sources. Now, so we've got three different types of codes here. In InVivo, they are called nodes. There's a lot of discussion at the beginning because among social scientists, they are approaching it either from the bottom up. Is your coding structure suggested by your sources, or from the top down? Are they driven by your research questions? Because we didn't have anyone who had any previous experience of this, ours was a rather pragmatic approach, so we tried out both. So some of them arose out of our sources, and some of them out from our research questions, the sort of questions we were thinking of. Where did members of the Cecil family get their knowledge of health matters? What authorities are being quoted in the sources? Who was giving the family advice? What illnesses and conditions were they suffering from? How did they understand health and sickness? How does the advice given by the medical professionals compare with that given by friends and other lay people? So, very disparate questions. Some of these are attitudes, some of these are very straightforward to define. What conditions? Others are much more difficult. What are the authorities? God arrived in the same part of the authorities as my grandmother, for example, because my grandmother was the authority for behind a particular receipt. So we were trying to be able to think of ways of including all of those. So the three of us would sit around discussing how this coding should take place, and I divided up the sources, and one looked at Salisbury, the other research assistant looked at the Lansdowne collections, and then we tried to pool our resources. And we kept records of exactly what we were trying to decide and how these codes should be brought together. So on this side, the free nodes, a very disparate list. It was just anything that didn't seem to have a connection with anything else at any particular time. So they live there, they can either remain there permanently or they can just stay there. I'm sorry that the print is rather small, but it goes from books, charity, conflict or disagreement, the cost of the treatment, whether any of them happen to be on the grand tour, which is obviously a big part of the upbringing of Cecil young males. So they are just there. They may be moved to join a hierarchy, that they may stay where they are. Underneath with the trees with a little symbol, these are where the concepts were brought together. And you can see the little plus signs down the side. If you want to expand any of them to see what trees come underneath those, then they can be expanded. Treatment is the one that I've expanded down here. Physic, procedures, regimen, bathing and taking the water, consulting doctors, and disability aids. So most of these arose out of the sources. And then when you expand them down here, they are listed up here, and you get all sorts of more detail, how many passages there are, which have got coding, so it helps you to see how significant a particular code is. And then at the bottom, it's got a description. So you've got a record of exactly what you thought that code meant, and so you can refer back to it. Sometimes we've altered them. This says that procedures, physic, is swallowed or applied. It could be a suppository or glisters. It includes vaporing and items such as apothecary's broth, distilled water. Includes all references, whether specified or brief references, generically, for example, in bills. So we can see what we're trying to do in that one. Now there is a third sort of coding, which is for people, which I will give you an example of in another slide. So having these hierarchical nodes helps to draw ideas together. It can suggest ways of further coding. It is very useful. It means that you haven't got a huge unwieldy list to go through when you're doing the coding. And it helps to suggest hypotheses. Here we've got an example of a coded document, and with the coding stripes on one side. And that shows what has been coded in that particular document. For example, and you can see on this side, we've got a person there, Elizabeth Cecil. She's identified as Elizabeth Cecil II, Dr. William Paddy. And then you've got here a long code for the experience of illness that this letter refers to. And what she's suffering from is ague, and that she's given physic to deal with it. We tried, when we were making these codes, always to use the language that was suggested by the sources. We didn't impose modern terminology, except in the case of mental health, which was a problem to us, so we put that in square brackets, because that doesn't appear as such in any of the sources. You've got there an admission that my problem with the Latin here that has a question mark next to it, because I haven't been able to finally decipher that just yet. Case nodes. Now, this green type along the top here are links. Now, this is where the advantage of having commercial software, because these are rather interesting links. Now, I'm going to now see if I can go back to. That's the project. And this link here, we inspect the data byte, and it goes to a family tree which I've devised, and so it means that you can move from one part to another. So I can check this Elizabeth Cecil. Who is here? And so I've got some notes on her. So if I want to check her out, I can do that. So that's a very helpful thing when you're writing out, to be able to do that. Okay, we haven't seen anything. This link for Robert Cecil. Unfortunately, I can't demonstrate that because I haven't got a subscription to the Oxford Dictionary of National Biography online here, but that's connected to ODNB, to his particular entry, so that I've got a straight link to that one. William Paddy, he has a link into Margaret Pelling's database, so I've got here the biography of William Paddy, so that can give me the data that I need, say, for writing index and things like that. So that's a very useful tool within the software. this one, this document, you can see it is coded along the side again, and one code covers the whole of the letter, and we've got some of these footnotes again in this one. This particular source is Dr. Smith's prescriptions for Lord Burghley from the April the 8th in 1594, and it's what Lord Burghley should be drinking in his broth, and there are a tremendous number of different plants and materia medica in this one. So there is a lot that could go into the glossary that I have developed. So if we just take this one, sorry, that link to the glossary. Now we will go back to, sorry. And that goes to the online glossary, which is there. Now that I put up some months ago as part of an interactive element. I was hoping that a lot of people would write in and tell me either where it was wrong or how to improve it. In fact, there has only been one known person who actually emailed me as a result of it. So I was sorry that it didn't become interactive. I thought this was an interesting experiment from my point of view. This one goes to the current version of the glossary, which has got a lot of changes. I've been talking to the Economic Botany Department at Kew Gardens, so this is now being changed, and then eventually when this is completed towards the end of the project, then it will be put online instead of the other version. But you can see here a working document that I can easily get from the project into this working document and find definitions of the different words. So that is an Excel table, so it's not part of the project, it's attached to it. So we have coding then, and the coding is crucial, as we've seen with the markup language. There's three different types of link. And these obviously can be made to other documents, to other sources outside. In addition to the contents of the documents, this tells you about the documents themselves and allows you to do some quantitative analysis. So down the side here, we have the individual documents, dates for the month, for the year, the document type, whether it's a report, whether it's a letter, receipts, the source, the writer, the gender of the sender of the document, if we know it, medical practitioner or not, and who the document is written to. And these are useful analytical tools about the sources. And it's possible to put all of this information about any of the individual documents which are listed. So we can do some basic quantitative analysis. The problem with this tool for historians is that I think it was really designed for a smaller number of longer documents. So there are certain kinds of physical things which are very difficult. You have to kind of watch the years running past your eyes and immediately light on the one that you are going to. But I'm sure that this can be changed if more historians use it. That's a small problem we've got around it. Then, of course, searching is crucial if you are to make use of all the coding and the structure of the documents. The search tool here, the type of search you can do, a single item or a combination. So a text search that everybody knows about, with a search on an individual node, the attribute values, which are about the documents with the years and so on, a Boolean search, which can combine nodes and attributes. The proximity search, I must say, I haven't done that. I think that's more for people who are analyzing text. And then you can choose whether you search particular set of documents or all of them, and you can, in this bottom one, you establish your context, whether you have just what's coded or whether you have the text that surrounds them. This is to show how a Boolean search works. You choose your node, in this case lay knowledge. I was particularly interested because as I coded the documents, it seemed to me that there were a huge number of letters sending advice, sending presents of physique or plants or other items to the Burleys, and the gender of the sender, because I was interested in how far women were part of this advice network. So this, the gender I selected was female. And this was the result when I selected women and lay knowledge. So, for example, this first one was from the Countess of Shrewsbury, who sent both Burleigh and Robert Cecil quite often presents of physic that she had made herself. In one case it was laudanum, another case distilled water. She would recommend quintessence of honey. She seems to have had quite a substantial practice of distilling over a long period of time. This The second one was quite interesting, was Lady Christian Sands. Her husband was in the Tower of London and he was rather sick, and she was saying that he's never been used to take medicine from anybody except me. And so she would happen to be also discussing health with Burley, and also on another occasion sent him direct advice. So here are women with great confidence sending the family advice. And this was, I think, a surprising result to me, and I think that it is largely the result of using software like this, which you could test your hypotheses, that here is lay knowledge that is being offered and being used by a family which has the money to pay for whatever medical help that they'd like. Their apothecary's bills are colossal, but at the same time, they are accepting amateur lay medical advice really quite frequently and for a number of different conditions. So my conclusions are that I think on one level QDA is a very effective data management tool to keep together disparate archives, organize them efficiently, and so you can keep tabs on what you've got in your project, even if they are spread over a number of repositories. That the time spent on setting up a clear structure is very well spent. It does. I worried in case we were going to run out of time before the end of the project. But actually, having a very clear structure has made a lot of difference to the writing up. That using CACDAS is a means of checking your data from a lot of different directions. You do different kinds of searches, and it also, because the program is quite flexible, it allows you to check from different ways, and you can go back and recode things if you think that you haven't done it quite correctly the first time or made adaptations. I think the rich search results, because the searches are so quick to do, you tend to try things out, and I think they throw up a great deal of information and suggest hypotheses. And I don't think that I would have been able to write the draft chapter, which is on lay knowledge, in the way that I could without this kind of software, because it's bringing up items from printed sources, from manuscript sources, and into a coherent whole. So I think it adds a lot of new dimensions to one's analysis. I think it's particularly suited for the kind of project that I'm engaged in, which is looking at attitudes and relationships, which are very hard to pin down. And I think it's the kind of work that Tim had referred to earlier on, started pioneered by Keith Thomas. But I think this kind of software means it's makes it much more thorough in its approach. You are not generalizing from one or two examples. I'm not suggesting that Keith Thomas was, but I think there have been occasions when anthropological historians have been in danger of doing that. But I think this gives you a much firmer foundation. And finally, I did manage to persuade the project directors to test out my hypothesis that actually it was easy to use and that it wasn't going to really complicate their lives too much. And quite recently I did give them a lesson on how to search and what, you know, what the different possibilities were, and they were actually quite delighted. I can't give you an endorsement just to prove that, but so that part of the project I think does work. So in conclusion, I think it's a useful tool, and I think it's particularly good for this kind of history. Thank you.